If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
This is Oyinlade Joe. I play Joanna Woshokun on Star Trek Discovery, and you're listening to The Greatest Discovery.
Captain!
Not here.
Captain!
Aboard.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happening?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons.
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica. Do you remember how to do a show about a Star Trek series that is longer than 22 minutes?
I was really under the gun schedule-wise today because I was like, I always try to watch episodes twice for these newer Trek shows because they're so dense.
Right. You don't want to miss a thing.
And I don't want to miss a thing. I was really up against it. I slid in under the wire, W/R/T, our recording time.
How about that? You made it.
I made it.
I've been here the whole time.
Neither of us had to do the, hey, can I get 15 minutes today?
No, we were ready to go. On time and on schedule. That's the Greatest Generation promise.
Yeah, which extends to cover The Greatest Discovery.
Right. It's an entire family of products, Ben.
Yeah.
I am excited to get back into adult Star Trek again. New Star Trek.
Yeah.
As we call it around here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I am too. I didn't know how much I missed it until I had it back.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I'd never want it to go away again.
Well, good news, Adam. It won't.
Yeah.
They're just going to make so much of this stuff.
Yeah, until we're dead. Yeah. It's great.
Renewable resource. I was thinking about that. Like, the thing that is amazing about Star Trek is that it kind of constantly reinvents itself and has new generations of fans. And I was thinking there will be, at some point in the future, somebody who is like a nostalgic look back podcast at Discovery specifically.
Yeah, with those kind of eyes, not contemporary eyes.
Remember the Star Trek we grew up with, the good one?
Yeah, this is that. This is that to them.
I mean, it probably won't be a podcast. There won't be podcasts in the future.
I wonder how useful the time off was. Like, I really wonder if for the last several weeks, Discovery post-production was like really working on these apps, yeah. Or if they were all in the can anyway, and this is just a planned schedule thing.
Yeah, well, we went to see them recording the music for the last episode of season 2, and that was pretty close to the release date of that episode, if memory serves.
Yeah, it was. I was surprised.
It was only like a few weeks away, and I mean, we know what schedule pressure feels like.
Sure.
And I can't even imagine what schedule pressure feels like when you're doing something as high profile as a hour-long prestige television show.
I don't know, man. Like, there's something about the vibe. Jeff Russo, friend of the podcast, real chill as a composer.
He doesn't know he's a friend of the podcast.
Most friends of the podcast don't know that they're friends of the podcast. But yeah, I mean, if that's the sort of schedule pressure you're under, it seemed to me as an outsider that it was not a stressful hang.
Yeah.
Making great music for the show.
Yeah. One thing that has always stuck in my mind about that is how many notes he got from the control room, you know?
Yeah.
Like every time they recorded a track, somebody would have a few things to suggest that they do differently in the next take. And they would like give that to him in an earpiece, and then he would transmit that to the various parts of the orchestra that he was conducting.
And there was a fair bit of translation happening there too, which I really liked.
Yeah, it was interesting to see how that worked, but also really interesting to see an artist at that level getting noted and, you know, not like getting notes can be really hard. It's going to be really hard to like take feedback of any kind, constructive or otherwise.
It makes me wish I had a translator, because I'm often the nitpicky note giver on stuff like our graphic materials. And that's tough. That's tough to be a creative and to get notes.
I think if you really were feeling the pressure, it would be easier to let that stuff get to you too. Yeah. So that's a very aspirational headspace that guy is able to get into.
Yeah, it is. We can only hope to be similar in our own productions and with the people that we work with, our growing myriad number of people.
Yeah. We got a team over here.
Well, what do you say, Ben? We've got such a long episode. I really want to get into all that there is to discuss.
Okay.
We catch ourselves up with Star Trek Discovery's fourth season. We're back with episode 8. I'm all in. All in being also the title of the episode. And if you'd forgotten what the first 7 episodes were about, we get a super long previously.
Yeah.
Here are the bullet points. Book's planet and all the birds on it were destroyed.
Birds.
We got a double black hole situation.
Whoa, that's so intense.
I mean, it's fine to take out a planet, but do you have to take the birds with it?
Starfleet thinks this is all the fault of unknown species 10C. Zora is self-aware. Culber is feeling bad. Tarka has his own spore drive and a bomb. Book and Tarka have left to go rogue. And Grudge is now living with Michael Burnham.
The opening of this episode is the immediate aftermath of Book and Tarka running off with a spore drive of their own and a plan to take the fight to the 10C, and Admiral Dad, who gets his email hacked in an embarrassingly simple phishing scheme, is fucking pissed.
He really brings the right energy to the proceeding, because Admiral Police Captain in a gritty crime thriller that's a casting mistake because he's distractingly attractive, like, has to immediately send ships into pursuit. It's like a real follow that car situation. But they can't follow the car because the car they need to follow has a spore drive. And it's jumped.
It could be anywhere. Literally anywhere.
This is kind of a dumb idea, Admiral.
Yeah. So he and Michael Burnham get hauled into the principal's office, where President Rillick lays into them for allowing this extremely dangerous situation to unfold, and she wants assurances that nobody knew that this was happening. Like, it's very embarrassing for the admiral because, you know, his security key got used. It's complicated for Burnham because she was like speaking against Book publicly and she has a personal relationship with him. You know, the admiral is like, okay, like, we know, like, what they need is they need isolinium to like make this bomb, and so they probably have like a few limited options as far as that goes. This is not like an explosive that you can just buy with a fake ID from the guy from Jurassic Park.
Right. Nor is Tarka, like the Val Kilmer of the situation, able to just go and buy it with a forged identification. Like,
that's exactly what I just said, from the guy from Jurassic Park. The lawyer from Jurassic Park is the guy he buys it from.
Is it?
Are you just a Twitter commenter? Are you saying the joke I just said?
That's what I do on this show.
That is not what you do on this show.
You don't know what we do on this show?
I don't think that's what we do. That's not what we do here.
That's not how it works.
Yeah, you're right.
So this is sort of...
It's double embarrassment, Ben.
It's double embarrassment, and it's that scene where, like, the police captain tells the detective, like, you're too close to the case, Burnham.
Right.
You're not on this one.
It's one of the rare moments I've been on President Rillick's side, to be honest. Like, not Rillick's fault.
Nope.
Rillick just says bad help.
Rillick got fucked over majorly in this, and she is also, like, feeling the looming embarrassment herself, because she just held the big conference to come up with this decision. And if the outcome of that conference is the opposite of the decision they made, she's going to look like a real fucking chump.
And I mean, that's the short term consequence, but the longer term one is like, she's been trying using the spore drive technology to get the Federation off of the dilithium teat.
Yeah.
And now they're going to be stuck to that teat forever.
Teat locked.
Yeah.
And all of those problems have to take a backseat to the idea that the Tenzi could retaliate and kill them all.
Right. Now is not the best time for Burnham to defend Book here in this scene. I was like, just bite your tongue, Burnham. Like, please stop this. And it's not a great mission to volunteer for either, Michael, again.
Right.
And Rilik is right to deny her request to participate in the Bring Book Back Better mission as it is on the table.
So we cut to Book's ship where he and Tarka are flying through some asteroids, and Tarka's like, so what do you think of the drive? Like, good interface, bad interface, anything you would tweak? I want suggestions here.
I mean, Book didn't get to put his hands in it, right? The new drive just sort of sunk into the panel, and that's how they do spore now?
We didn't really get to see it go down. I'm imagining that he...
We saw it going in, but we didn't see the spore shoot happen.
Did some goo come out of the panel after that and go over Book's hands?
None of your business.
I don't know. You'd need a blacklight for that.
Yeah. We get to see some digital wanted posters of these two. And APB has gone out for their whereabouts, and Book is starting to sweat some of the consequences of the choices that they're making. And Tarka's like, dude, you don't have to worry about any of that stuff. Like, we're going to save the galaxy. We're going to be heroes.
Once the insurrection's over, we'll get full pardons.
I mean, what Tarka leaves unsaid here, and I kind of wanted Book to call him on, was, I'm not even going to be in this universe.
Right, exactly.
Like, I don't care at all.
If this works, Tarka gets away scot-free, so scot-free that he does not exist anymore in a way that could be arrested.
Yeah, he's going to be so far outside the jurisdiction that it's not a problem. But
what they're going to need to arrest him is a time cop, Ben.
Walker.
They're going to have to go back to the year 1994.
You know who else I think might need a time cop? You're going to need a time cop.
Yeah. Things didn't work out very well for Yor.
Yeah.
On that beat.
Tarka could wind up in just as bad of shape.
One thing comes as a surprise to Book in this scene, and it's that they don't already have the bomb-making material they need to make this thing work.
Yeah.
Tarka neglected to mention that when they took his ship.
I was counting on getting federal assistance with that, but...
Yeah. Oops.
Yeah. So they kind of do the math. Like, Starfleet is probably shaking down all of the normal distribution sites for this. So we're going to have to kind of take an end run around that. Book has an idea of another source for isolinium. And they decide that that's where they're going to head.
We cut back over to Admiral. I trusted someone who broke my heart and I may never get over it. Giving Michael Burnham the backstory on Tarka. And they're just trading all sorts of guilt currency in this scene. You don't get it, Michael. I feel responsible. And I've put my family in danger. You'll never understand. And Burnham's like, Book was my family, idiot. We're talking about the same person. Like, two versions of the same person, I mean.
Yeah. Listen, Admiral, mansplaining his trauma to somebody who's experienced equivalent or greater trauma. I know what you're talking about. But the Admiral quickly kind of pivots to, hey, listen, like, I know you have a mission to go find information about the Tenzi, like, get as much information about the area of space that they are located in before you head there to make first contact is your mission. But what I want you to do is think creatively about how you can also nab Book and Tarka while you're doing that mission.
The Admiral's like, ordinarily, I like installing captains that are originalists when it comes to my orders. Real letter of the law type. But what I want you to be on this mission is more of a modernist. Kind of take it in a modern interpretation.
I want this to be sort of an activist mission.
Yeah.
Pursuing our shared goals right. while you're in this position.
So you mean like any starship captain we've ever seen on Star Trek ever? Is that what you're saying, Admiral?
He's like, you're picking up what I'm putting down.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of an interesting moment, right? Like, I couldn't say this in front of Rylik because we have to present a unified front.
Right.
But also, like, Rylik is no stranger to let's present a unified front while you go sneak around and do some shit for me.
Exactly.
Burnham meets with Saru and Stamets, who have been doing some research on this area of space. And it's like, there's like a sphere that's been edited out of the star map. And they can tell that there's like gravity, so there's stuff there, but they don't know anything about it. And it's kind of beyond the explored space of the Federation. But the Emerald Chain did have contact with some people called the Stilf, who live like next door to the Ten C. So maybe they'll know what the Ten C's reputation is.
Burnham, from her time as a space pirate, may have a friend who can give them some useful maps of the area.
Yeah.
Of how to get to this neighbor, maybe, right?
I know some Emerald Chain adjacent people. Maybe we can get some stealth space scans from them.
Yeah. It's always awkward to go knock on a neighbor's door. Yeah. Unannounced, right? Hey, so my kid lost a ball in your backyard. And what's crazy is like your backyard gobbled up like a whole galaxy of kids.
I couldn't help but notice you have a really big scary dog back there.
Yeah.
And I don't want that ball to be back there forever.
Right. Who's going to go with Burnham on this mission is the question, because we're used to Burnham going alone or with Book. Burnham needs a new Book.
She does.
And she tells Saru that Owa will be the new Book.
Yeah. And not Saru.
Yeah.
I guess that's just because Saru, being a red jacket now, gets to get left in command of the starship.
I like Owa more and more, and especially, you know, by the end of the episode. But this episode becomes incredibly funny if it's Saru who goes on this mission instead.
Doing all the same yeah. shit Owo does.
Like, do not change a single thing except Saru for Owo. And this episode is incredible. Saru just murdered a guy in that boxing ring with like a mule kick.
Kicked a fucking hole in his chest. That guy kicks like Mike Tyson punches.
Saru also plays in the poker game, and his disgusting fingers holding the cards make everyone yeah. else fold.
Yeah. He's got to tell. He strokes his fingers, and it makes everybody barf.
All the people started getting sick and throwing up all over each other.
So Tarka and Book show up at a spot that Book refers to as Haz Mazaro's Karma Barge on Parathia.
Were you familiar with what a karma barge was? I replayed this scene 10 times, and I was like, I'm pretty sure they said karma barge. I don't know what that is.
I also, because of Book's accent, I wasn't sure if he was saying Haz Mazaro or Haz Mazaro.
Yeah.
It's Haz, but yeah, there was a... It took me a while. I had to play this back for myself as well. Haz Mazaro's Karma Barge. Welcome.
Haz Mazaro's Karma Barge. Haz Mazaro's Karma Barge.
Red leather, yellow leather. Red leather, yellow leather.
The club is pretty cool.
Yeah. It's kind of a Quark's Bar kind of energy in here. A lot of riffraff, a lot of shady characters drinking and gambling and...
There's a Chekhov's boxing ring in the middle.
This karma barge, you can really buy anything here. Like, if you can't gamble for it out on the floor, there's a... Unlike the Gap, where everything that they have is out, there is a back area with a lot more stock.
Right.
At Haz Mazaro's karma barge.
There's always a back area.
Yeah.
Finally meet Haz Mazzaro of Haz Mazzaro's Karma Barge. Ooh, I almost missed that one. I hit the mat after landing and kind of did the wobble.
But you stuck it. You stuck it.
Haz Mazzaro of Haz Mazzaro's Karma Barge has a Guinan hat without the hat. Like, that's how his head looks.
Yeah, it's just built into his loaf.
Yeah. And we get brought into the aforementioned back room with him.
Yeah. Haz Mazzaro, happy to see Book, whose code name here is Glowworm. Haz Mazzaro is trying to sell them on some like scanning equipment or something. And Tarka goes off to kind of like look through the wares. And Haz Mazzaro's like, who is that guy? What's the deal with his attitude? And Book explains what they're there for. Like, hey, man, we need some isolinium. We need good isolinium. None of this bullshit. But we brought money. I know you've been pissed at me in the past, but how about all of this latinum that I just pulled out of my jacket? And Haz Mazzaro's like, that'll be plenty to pay off your debt.
Oops. Yeah. Book needed to get square before going straight.
Yeah. And it turns out that Book owes Haz Mazzaro for disrupting transworm commerce. Like, the thing that Haz Mazzaro considers Book to owe him for was like fucking up somebody's ship who was illegally transporting worms. And I guess maybe that's where the glowworm name comes from.
I mean, maybe, but
Book is like, I told that guy not to transport transworms. So, you know, it's not my fault that he was nearly ruined and it took him 6 months to get his business back going.
Kind of a bad look for Book.
Yeah.
To be honest, you don't like a guy who walks away from a debt.
Yeah. Yeah. It looks like they're pretty much screwed here. Haz Mazzaro is like on his way to kicking them out of his office when Book is like, wait. I know there's a lot of people counting cards over there in your casino that can really affect the bottom line. And you don't want to live with the ignominy of having run a casino that failed.
We think it's going to be a tremendous success.
You'd never be taken seriously as a businessman.
So the offer to get square is Book is like, if we can catch gambling cheats on your gambling floor here, will that make us even for the debt that I owe you and also all of this explosive material that we want to buy?
Yeah, this highly illicit weapons grade isolinium, can it be bought for catching some guys counting cards?
It sounds like a deal that Haz Mazzaro accepts if you can understand what the fuck they're saying without subtitles at the end of this scene. I played this part another 10 times. Yeah. I could not figure out what they were saying.
All the things.
They don't have closed captioning on the screeners that we get.
Yeah.
So
I feel like Haz Mazzaro was saying some sort of colloquialism, like that was...
Yeah, well, so he has
contextually fitting with the situation, but I didn't get it because I didn't have the context.
I actually kind of liked this about Haz Mazzaro, is that he speaks in idiomatic language a lot of the time. And yeah, it's stuff like, I didn't know Cardassians had a particular affinity for cake, but I guess I'll take your word for it, Haz Mazzaro.
Right.
Like, you seem awful sure.
I guess cake is what they call the blood of Bajorans. I don't know.
Yeah. How do you think President Rillick feels about cake? Is she only like one quarter interested in it?
I don't know. I'd like to find out.
Yeah.
President Rillick wanted to be president so she could be the girl with the most cake.
Yeah.
Whatever the cost.
I usually don't care for cake, but our buddy Josh sent us some cupcakes recently, and I really enjoyed my cupcake.
Right? I love taking a cupcake to the dome.
Yeah.
Does it feel like modern cupcakes hit so much harder than they did when you were a kid? Like when it was a kid's birthday or something and cupcakes were on the menu?
Yeah.
It feels like even as a kid, the biggest cupcake was still pretty small.
Yeah.
And now cupcakes are like fucking bowling balls. They're so big.
They're the size of a baby's head.
They're so sweet.
They're so buttery now.
Yeah.
I think that's because like the frosting on those cupcakes from the grocery store when you were a kid tastes like a petroleum product.
Mm-hmm.
And I never liked it. I never liked it even when I was a kid. Like I was like, I like that it's sweet, but I don't like how fucking...
Yeah.
Like weird it tastes, basically. And the buttercream completely solves for that.
You do that thing where you pull off the stump and put it on top of the frosting so that you can eat it like a sandwich? You got to. That's the best way to eat a cupcake.
Yeah.
If you're not pulling off the stump and putting it on top of the frosting, try it. It'll change your life.
You don't marinate the stump when it's a cupcake.
Yeah. Cut it in half like a cheeseburger and then pull the stump parts off, put them on top of the frosting. It's a much better way to eat a cupcake.
Any questions?
So they make this deal. Book has an opportunity to earn Isolidium. And we cut to the shuttle where Burnham and Owo are on their way toward Parathia. And Owo is like, hey, Cap, like, kind of weird that you picked me. Like, mostly people that work on the bridge never get to do missions. So
I don't usually get this much dialogue most episodes. Yeah. And so, like, I'm just want to prepare you. Like, if I start to just trail off, it's because I've never done this before.
I don't know how to talk this much. And also, like, I'm sure that it got back to you that I was, like, a little bit out of hand in a recent episode.
Right.
And I apologize to Saru. And so if this is about that, like, you wanted to keep a closer eye on me, like, I learned my lesson. The captain is kind of like, hey, actually, sort of kindred spirit energy between the two of us.
Yeah.
Like, I know that feel super well, Owo.
Yeah, Owo's there because she's got some backbone.
Yeah. We're going to need backbone. It's not, not just your star chart validation skills.
They're going to need backbone when they fly the shuttle into a hollow monster that is obscuring the karma barge inside.
I loved this landing sequence. This was so exciting.
Haas Mizaro's hollow monster karma barge.
I also love seeing what the karma barge actually looked like from the outside.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it a lot.
They would have just described that on Star Trek Voyager. They would never have had the resources to show the outside of the karma barge.
Now you cut to the wide shot. You can see the whole thing.
Yeah.
Everything above the waterline anyway. There's a whole lot of karma barge beneath the waterline, Ben.
I was sort of wondering, because they talk about, like, oh, we're going into a place where Starfleet does not have any jurisdiction. We're not going to be able to bring guns or anything. I was kind of imagining that they would get into civilian clothing and try and do this a little bit more on the down low, but they go in the regalia.
It's such Starfleet hubris to do this.
Sheer fucking hubris.
Definitely not a couple of narcs here. This is just the only change of clothes I have.
I mean, the group of people in this casino, I feel like, would have made them as Starfleet either way. They'd be like, look at the shoes. They walk weird. They're Starfleet.
I mean, this is where Saru instead of Owo would have been a very interesting choice.
If Glowworm was too cutesy a name for you, Burnham's nom de guerre for interacting with Haas Mizaro is Right Hook Burnham. Yeah.
Tale for another time.
She's also on very friendly terms with him. And
you're going to be very surprised when you learn what that has to do with.
You're also going to be very surprised when she's not the one doing the right hooks later in the episode.
Yeah. You get the feeling of uh-oh right away, because this is the very same karma barge that Book and Tarka were just at.
Yeah. Like, are they going to run into each other at the craps table? Or have Book and Tarka already left? And you're not sure initially. And Burnham comes in and, like, gives Haas Mizaro a bunch of money. And she's like, cool, we're here to buy Isolinium. And he's like, that would be great, except for I sort of, like, already have an agreement with somebody about some of that. And there's only so much. So, bit of an awkward situation. You also didn't bring enough money.
This is the moment where Burnham gives Owo the chance to take the off-ramp to the story. She's like, look, Owo, you're a bridge officer, and you don't normally get this far into an episode's A story before you're gone. And so if you would be more comfortable taking the exit here, I'd understand.
Right.
I usually do these missions by myself.
Takes a hell of a big ego, no?
Or with Book, but he's the B story today.
And this is a great moment for Owo, because she doesn't take that off ramp. She's into the mission no matter what. And she knows it's her only chance at a storyline.
She woke up this morning and chose mission.
Yeah. Elsewhere in the club, we find that Tarka and Book have not left. They're there. They're just on the other side. They're on the hunt for cheaters, gambling cheaters. And I found it really weird that Book didn't use his glowy powers to find this cheater.
I did too.
Never even attempts it.
Yeah, maybe it's too showy, or maybe his glowy powers don't work like that, but yeah. It would have been nice to at least hear why.
Yeah, instead he uses just regular ass powers of observation to see an alien blinking strangely. And he's like, that's the guy. That guy's up to no good.
But that guy, you know, it's one of those like somebody passes in front of the camera and that guy is gone.
Yeah.
He like jumped behind the newspaper delivery van that was passing. And so the hunt continues, and we get the sense that there's lots of like other crimes going on, pickpocketing and stuff.
Sure.
People that don't have their passport and that weird skin colored belt under their shirt came into the wrong casino.
It's funny how Haas Mazzaro's karma barge is depicted as being extremely dangerous, but the only danger we see is cheating at gambling.
Right.
No one feels lethal in this room.
Yeah. I mean, there was that one guy that like bumped his shoulder into Owo and was a bit of a dick about it, but that's not like everybody in here.
Oh.
Michael Burnham catches up with Book after Tarka wanders off. And she's like, hey, so we seem to have found ourselves on the same karma barge. Weird coincidence. Why don't we have a discussion about you maybe not putting the safety of the entire galaxy at risk so that Tarka can escape to a different universe?
Of all the karma barges and all the water planets, we have to meet up at Haas Mazzaro's karma barge.
Hi, this is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
All right, class. Tomorrow's exam will cover the science of cosmic rays, the morals of art forgery, and whether or not fish can drown. Any questions? Yes, you in the back.
What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything,
where we learn about science and a bit of everything else. My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
Book is pot committed. He is not interested in being talked out of his thing.
Or the idea that he'll be forgiven if he goes through it, right?
Right, yeah, she's saying.
Because Burnham's like, look, you can take the bomb-making material. That's fine. Like, I'm not going to stop you from doing that, but why don't you take it and turn it in?
And turn in Tarka.
Yeah.
I'll make sure that the DA considers your cooperation when considering sentencing.
And Book is like, you knew when you met me, baby, that you'd have to share me with every holographic whale monster casino in the galaxy.
This is not sharing. This is leftovers.
You read the terrain looking for isolidium.
I'm on the edge of Haas Mazzaro's karma barge, where I gotta be.
It keeps my gambling sharp.
Yeah. So Burnham, you get the sense that Burnham's going to stop him, but it's not going to happen right then and there.
Yeah.
She goes right up to Haas Mazzaro of Haas Mazzaro's karma barge about buying the isolinium out from under Book.
Yeah. Let's make a deal. What do I got to get you? And he's like, well, like I saw what you had in your bag. You're going to need to triple it. And she like gets out her iPhone and he was like, no. Do not call any more Federation. This is a one Federation mission at a time karma barge, and I don't want a lot of those guys breathing down my neck.
Do you think Michael Burnham was terrible at her space piracy job? Because this is a bad look for someone who used to run in these circles.
Yeah, I mean, she's relying on the largesse of the Federation at this time. I feel like she should have just come with way more dough.
Yeah.
But Owo's got an idea for how they can get their bands up.
As a degenerate gambler, Ben, I do want to say that you never want to go to the casino with all your money.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to do it.
And you're not supposed to count it while you're sitting at the table.
You want to leave your debit cards at home.
I wondered how you felt in this scene, because the end of this scene is very much the turn to, we're going to get our bands up by gambling it in Hazmizarro's karma barge, and we're going to have to triple our money while we're here.
Yeah.
Was that an exciting turn in the episode for you, or was it an eye roll because the possibility of tripling your money in a casino is so far-fetched?
I was excited about the idea that it could go there, but instead it turns into sacrificing Owo's body in the boxing ring.
Yeah, but before we get to that, we have a grief transference scene between Culber and Stamets. Stamets comes home and finds Culber kind of stress cleaning.
You're stressed.
I'm not stressed.
You're also cleaning.
And yelling at the Roomba.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
Not a good look to yell at the Roomba.
Yeah.
No!
He has not gotten better. No improvement since his therapy session.
Even Stamets can tell he's out of sorts.
The first social cue Stamets has picked up on in 3 seasons.
Right. Culber is upset because he feels responsible for Book's actions. And Stamets states the obvious, that you and me and everyone else who watches the show understands that a person is never responsible for someone else's actions.
And they're all stressed because of this being the 4th season in a row where the fate of the universe lies in the balance.
Yeah.
He's like, hey, we can all relate. Let's go through the stress together. Let's face the fear as a team and not isolate each other.
Maybe some holodeck would be a restorative distraction from all of our troubles.
Sometimes it needs a little shush.
A date, just what the doctor ordered. The doctor of fungal science.
When they leave, like, we hang in the scene for a few extra seconds and we see the dot get to work with the black light and then we cut away.
Yeah, there is a lot of cum on that wall.
That's what I'm saying. Like, we cut away before we see just how much, but we see a fair amount.
Like, the particle effects coming off the wall, prodigious.
How unusual do you think it is to manually clean anything in this century? Yeah. Like, would anyone even know how?
That would have been a really funny punch up in the script if Culber was, like, doing a terrible job of cleaning.
Yeah, well, the ship cleans for us.
I mean, I'm using a brushy thing in the toilet, and the only brushy thing I knew of were these black toothbrushes. I mean, is that what you use? I don't know.
My friend Andrew Walsh has a show called The Spotless Podcast where he talks with his co-host about their mutual love of cleaning.
Mm.
And they occasionally will do a segment where they review a scene in a movie or a television show where somebody cleans something and, like, rate how clean they think that actually got the room.
You know, I have a suggestion for them over on that podcast. If they ever want the show to end and they're looking for a way out, one of them should just get a puppy.
Yeah, I don't think Andrew's going to do that.
Yeah. Maybe file that away. Put that in the back pocket, Andrew.
So we come back to Hazmizarro's karma barge, where Owo has entered the octagon against the, like, 6'8" monster man that shouldered her on their way into the casino.
This guy's an absolute unit, and he's got that in-ring confidence of someone just sort of slouching on the ropes.
Mm-hmm. He is like 3 or 4 weight classes bigger than Owo.
And for that disparity, Owo gets totally thunderlipsed into the ring, like picked up and dropped.
Yeah.
I think that Burnham did a bad job in giving Owo her nickname.
Yeah.
I don't think naming her after a Jersey Shore character was the right move here.
So I threw my drink in her face.
For all the bad work she did in that, I did like Carnival Barker mode for Michael Burnham.
That was fun. I did like that too.
Yeah. It would be really fun to do that, you know?
This fight goes so poorly, and the rematch is asked for and granted so fast that at this point, I really started to feel concerned for OO and her safety.
Yeah, because it's not like hustling pool where losing doesn't get you thrown 6 feet down onto the mat by a huge man with a beard.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but is there anything in OO's backstory that suggests abilities in this area? Like, she trains with Detmer a lot with the punching dummies and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But I got the sense that Detmer was more of the pugilist than OO was for some reason.
I don't know exactly. I mean, I sort of wondered after this first fight how much OO was in control of the situation and she was just letting it look like she got badly beat the first time.
Yeah, I mean, this is a professional power imbalance here that is kind of scary.
Yeah.
Were you to scrutinize it more than a little bit?
Right. I mean, I was like, I hope she has like Wolverine claws or something.
Yeah, I mean, Burnham is the one with the nickname Right Hook.
Tale for another time.
Yeah.
Why isn't her ass in the ring?
I don't know.
OO knows she can't say anything because OO is going to get kicked off of the A story if she does.
I was like, yeah, keep me in, coach. Book and Tarka have a little conversation while the second round is going on. We don't even really get to watch the second of the three fights because Book and Tarka are still on the hunt for the gambling thieves. And now they're beginning to think that there may be a ring, like a coordinated ring, because they see another alien doing rhythmic blinking.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, so they're signaling to each other. We got to figure out who is in the ring, who's doing the signaling and to whom and about what. And if we can do that before OO definitely wins this fight, we can get the Isolinium.
I guess. Third time's a charm.
I mean, like, Book has so much fucking faith in Burnham because he's like, I know that it looks like, oh, wow, is getting her ass handed to her over there. Trust me, she is not.
Yeah. The odds have changed so much by the time the third fight rolls around that it's 45-1. And Burnham bets it all on OO in the third and deciding match. Mm-hmm. The blocking of this scene telegraphs the ball shot, right?
Yeah, and I guess this isn't like Marquess of Queensberry rules on Hazmizaro's karma barge, because below the belt is fair game on the karma barge.
It turns out in this ring, all aliens do keep their genitals in the same place.
She fucking tunes this guy up, beats him really badly, and goes for the big payout. This is sort of like happening right at the same time as Book and Tarka realize that the guy that they've been tracking is a shapeshifter. OO and Burnham are like getting their payout, and the guy that represents the other fighter is accusing them of having hustled the game.
A real Giovanni Ribisi looking dude.
Yeah, yeah. The fighter has like a hollow knife that he pulls out, and Book catches this and goes in and knocks the guy onto the pool table. And weirdly, this pool table has been drained of water.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was weird. I mean, Book sets him up and then Burnham knocks him out, though.
Yeah. Hazmizaro's Karma Barge does seem like a place that is asking for a cat lady to dance on the bar. And does not have that.
Does feel like that kind of place.
Kind of strange.
Yeah. They can't celebrate too long because the changeling gets spotted once again. And the changeling has kind of a cool exit strategy by turning themselves into a tribble.
A turbo tribble.
Like, kind of like if you could turn yourself into an RC car and get out of a room full of people. That's what this person does. And then Tarka, using a little handheld device, immobilizes this person and reveals them to be a founder.
Yeah. What the fuck? And they're still doing bad Odo face. Mr. Bucket.
Yeah. I love that Odo face continuity.
This puts the A and the B stories in direct conflict with each other because Book has completed his find the gambling thief mission right as Michael Burnham has completed her get all the money we need storyline. And how's Mizarro's like, well, awkward.
And because Burnham and Book are reunited on the A story, Owo takes four giant steps backwards out of the scene, turns and walks away.
She makes eye contact with Tarka and just nods her head off into a deep corner.
Yeah.
Why don't you come with me?
Where they're going to spend the rest of the episode.
Hazma Zara explains to Book and Burnham, there's only one way to resolve this, and it is through a poker game. I've contacted a couple of my regulars, the most suburban Canadian-looking crime lords in the galaxy.
We didn't even have to get them into costumes or makeup. This is just how they came.
These are just people that hang around in Toronto.
We had to tell them to stop smoking cigarettes for the next few hours. And that was all they had to do.
Yeah. So they get to look at the goods. They get to inspect the Isolinium before the gambling match. And the two newcomers get to go first.
Hey, do you think that the founder that they found earlier makes Hazma Zaro's place of business the Karma Chameleon Barge?
Yeah, I think that math checks out.
All right. I just couldn't let that go. That has to be in the show, Ben.
If I had thought of it, I wouldn't have been able to either. Yeah. But I didn't. Wouldn't these people who would otherwise be on a Canadian real estate show are off in the other room? Burnham and Book are like, did you see those guys? They're trying to be the next Osira, but less scary seeming.
Yeah.
They are holdouts from the Emerald Chain. And neither of them really like the idea of them going for the gold. So they come up with an agreement to kind of team up to eliminate those two from the game first. And then it's going to be a, you know, let the best person win.
Yeah. They're going to settle the matter of who gets the Isolinium at the poker table, a storyline that would have been perfect in 1998.
Well, you feeling satisfied now, Teddy?
I mean, it's a real Casino Royale feeling, right?
Yeah. It's winner take all, and we cut to the card game in progress. And I want a deck of these cards, Ben. It seems like you could play with them.
I know. I really hope that they put these out.
Yeah.
They look great.
Michael Burnham is not a fun person to play poker with because she is very dramatic and very chatty.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. You know, she's running game. She's dramatic and chatty to be annoying to the other two people.
Well, right. I mean, she's a storytelling instrument for the viewer too, because we need her dialogue to act as a form of voiceover to the action.
Right, because we're not like actually seeing a real poker game play out where we can't actually follow what's going on with the cards. What we can follow is Michael Burnham and how much Hazma Zaro seems to love dealing cards. Every time somebody gets eliminated or a big pot goes to somebody, Hazma Zaro incredibly entertained by this.
Yeah, kind of feels like bad karma barge to celebrate someone's loss like that.
Yeah. Kind of a dick move for the casino owner.
My raft, my rules.
We only see one hand, you know, go turn by turn, and the rest of the poker is played out via montage.
It kind of looked like a variation on Texas Hold'em, though, right?
It did, yeah. Book's hand gestures and stuff are so blatant in telegraphing what he's doing and the information he wants to convey to Burnham that it just seems impossible that Hazma Zaro would let this happen unless Hazma Zaro were somehow involved and wanting the result to go in a certain way. That's not the angle this story takes at all.
I mean, we've established that Hazma Zaro has a huge problem with people gambling in a dishonest way in his facility.
It turns out he's extremely bad at running his karma barge.
Yeah. How did he get this karma barge in the first place when he's this bad at it?
I don't know.
One of the cutaways during the gambling is to a little conversation between Owo and Tarka. And Tarka's like, I bet you fucking wish you could just arrest me and haul me back by the fucking short and curlies, right? And Owo's like, I mean, like, I kind of get what you're doing. I understand your motivation.
Owo has been punched in the face and head a number of times, has been thrown into the ground as hard as that giant guy could do it.
Yeah.
Seems all right.
Yeah. She hasn't waved a light over her split open cheekbone, though.
Yeah. Owo just will not stop needling Tarka.
What is it then?
Yeah. With all these little questions.
So who's it about then?
About his motivations.
Someone who's gone?
And Tarka plays it off before finally getting affected by her.
Yeah. He says he doesn't really feel like he has a choice because of the extent to which he has lost.
Yeah.
And I sort of wonder if that is being set up as something that will pay off as real. You know, like, we've been talking on our Prodigy episodes about, like, will the diviner's methods seem reasonable given what he's actually doing when that is revealed?
I would be very surprised if one of the takeaways from the season was, if only we could understand evil. We might be able to get with their way of thinking.
But, like, the point here is that Book sees Tarka's goal is aligned with his own, despite the fact that Tarka is clearly trying to, like, skip out once they're done delivering the bomb to the DMA. Owo can, like, philosophically understand Tarka, even though she doesn't agree with him. But, like, what is the loss? Is the loss just that Tarka's friend is in the other universe? Is that it? Do we already know it? Or is there something bigger and more fucked up?
I think there's got to be more to it than that.
Yeah, I kind of do too.
And this is a show that relishes the waiting for that. Like all new Star Trek relishes that.
Yeah.
Much in the same way as TNG was about relishing in your birdie.
This is about relishing in your karma.
Yeah. Back at the table, it is it's heads up action between Book and Michael Burnham. And Book has a distinct chip advantage. And when these cards come, Burnham starts talking about what would happen if Book were to win, which is Book being forever guilty, forever alone, and forever without Michael Burnham. And I think there's an interesting compositional thing happening here in this scene, Ben. I wonder if you noticed this. Everything is tack sharp on Michael Burnham.
Yeah.
And I think they're using a lens on Book that warps his face.
Oh, yeah.
You know how sometimes you can go, like, you can rent a lens that's like 40 years old?
Yeah.
And it's artistic in its weird properties.
Right.
It's imperfect in ways that are very pleasing in certain situations. And I feel like this is an old lens or something that they're using on his face, or there's some sort of effect happening because there's something about Book when you see his face that is a little bit askew.
Yeah, I think it might just be that it's a very wide lens, and the one that they're shooting Michael Burnham with is considerably longer relative to it. But yeah, it does really, like, make the two of them feel like they're in a very different place, which only heightens the tension between them as she kind of makes the case that, like, this is a Rubicon. Like, if you win this hand and walk out of here with the Isolidium, it's like when you launch the final mission in a video game and, like, the game throws up a little dialogue that says, like, you want to make sure that you've got all of the, like, bows and arrows that you can collect before you go beyond this point, because there's no turning back.
Right. I just really like how this scene doesn't go Dutch angle or doesn't get shaky cam or anything. Like, it's just really subtle with this choice. I dug it. Book goes all in, and Burnham calls, and Burnham and me thought that Book was bluffing.
Yeah.
She calls him with her straight, thinks that's a winning hand, but that straight loses to Book's flush, and Book wins.
Book wins the whole damn thing. Haslamaro puts the Isolinium, which kind of looks like a very fancy dildo still in its packaging.
Yes.
On the poker table. Walks out.
It looks like a Webby Award.
I mean, it's like a very little Webby Award.
Yeah.
I have a Webby Award. It's big.
I know.
It's very big and impressive.
Everyone likes your Webby Award, Ben.
Not quite.
And that's it. We're back on Book's ship now. And Tarka's like, hey, bud, don't worry about it. You fucked your girlfriend over. You know, you made huge sacrifices, but anything worth doing is worth sacrificing for.
Yeah, I mean, and this is consistent with your observation earlier in the episode, which is like easy for Tarka to say.
Yeah.
Tarka's like, hey, everyone's going to understand what this is over. You're going to be a hero. And Book in his mind has got to be like, yeah, but you're going to be gone. No matter what.
I wanted Book to say this.
Yeah.
It was driving me nuts that Book didn't say that.
Yeah.
Like, we can have them continue to work together and still have conflict between them.
It makes these scenes even more delicious if it's out on the table like that, if that conflict is there. I don't get leaving it unsaid, because it's certainly not even suggested by what either of them are doing or saying.
Like, you could forget that that's an element of it if you didn't remember the last episode that well after a bunch of weeks away from Discovery.
Yeah.
Burnham and the Admiral and President Rilik meet back up now that the mission is over. And Rilik is like, hey, so first of all, atta girl for spotting a loophole that you could exploit in your orders and finding Book. But what the fuck were you thinking not arresting him?
I offered you a chance to be a cop and you blew it.
Yeah, he was right there.
Admiral, Secret Service agent, attached to the presidential detail one last time, throws himself in front of this bullet, and he's like, listen, Burnham was way beyond her jurisdiction. She was not armed. She didn't have any way of doing that, but we got a lot of intel out of this. And Burnham is like, not only that, I put a tracker on the dildo.
Yeah.
Just like Spock did Kirk that one time.
You see it all the time, except this is one of those trackers that disappears and doesn't stick onto a wool uniform like like a Brillo pad.
Yeah. It's not like one of those GPS devices from the movies that has like a really obvious red LED light that blinks. And it's like, wouldn't the spies notice the blinking light on the fucking bumper of their car?
I really love the flashback here. And I've got to believe that this was an intentional choice where you see the finger stick the tracker onto the Webby Award, and it doesn't disappear for like 2 seconds longer than you think it would.
Yeah, like, you're like, that does not seem super discreet. Yeah. And then it disappears.
I love that part.
It's really good. I also liked rewatching it because in the earlier scene with her and the Isolinium, that like, it's below the frame, like where she does it, but you can see that she has something in her hand if you look closely in the wide shot.
Yeah.
It's really nice. So President Rilik is like, wow, like you are really great at captaining. I am sorry that I laid into you like that. We now have a position on Book and Tarka.
We now have a position of a ship that could spore jump away the second we arrive on scene.
Yeah. So we're going to have to surprise attack because you only get one shot.
Yeah.
Then we have to have a final McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
Down in engineering where Stamets and Saru talk them through the results of the research they've done on the part of space that the 10C live in. And this is not great news. The 10C have a huge force field around their entire star system that probably takes an unimaginable amount of energy to create. And as they're working through this, Michael Burnham is like,
DMA! What does this involve? DMA!
What if the DMA is like not leaving a certain thing behind as it randomly scrapes through space? What if there's something disappearing like boronite? And everybody's like, boronite? She's like, yep, boronite. Let's look for residual boronite.
The clothes washing detergent?
Heavy stuff.
Well, it's not precisely a detergent, but it can enhance the function of your detergent. Right.
So Zora does a quick study and Zora is able to confirm it. Boronite, absent from all of these areas. The DMA is kind of a threshing machine for this boronite.
Yeah, it's a mining device, which really feels like they're biting the rhyme of the 2009 Star Trek movie.
Right.
Mining device having killed planet Vulcan.
The big takeaway is if this species throws away this kind of technology on their mining equipment, what the hell kind of weapons do they have when they really mean it?
Yeah. Scary to contemplate and seems like information that might cause Book and Tarka to reconsider what they are doing.
I mean, if only they could be talked out of it, which they can't be. OWO tried.
Doesn't seem like they are open to hearing other people's positions on the matter.
Yeah. I am very open to hearing your position on whether or not this was a good episode, Ben. Did you like it?
I did like it. I feel like this episode was a refreshing return to Discovery for me. You know, I think we've talked a little bit about like just how much unpacking trauma has seemed to be attendant to each episode of this season so far. And there is a little bit of that in this, but it felt like they kind of drew it back a little bit and made this more of a fun adventure in a casino. And like the fact that OWO got in an octagon, I like couldn't have seen that coming when the episode started, and the twists and turns were really fun, and I enjoyed it. And I feel like Hasmazaro's Karma Barge is just like what a fun setting, what a fun character. Like, I feel like I'll think about that for a long time. How about you?
Today I learned what a Karma Barge was. Which the show seems to suggest has always been a thing.
Right.
Which I don't like feeling like that. I don't like feeling that kind of stupid. Like, you didn't know what a Karma Barge was. Obviously, they're all over the place, idiot.
Yeah.
I didn't like that feeling, but I did like the episode for all the reasons you stated. And I think this show is stronger when more people are involved in the story.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of Sonequa Martin-Green. I think she's a great actor. But I feel like Discovery promised itself as an ensemble, and it's never lived up to that promise, if it ever was one. And I really like the episodes where they invite the rest of the characters along for its storytelling. And this is an example of that. Like, we get so few of these where we get to bring a bridge crew person along for a mission.
Makes no damn sense.
Yeah.
And I don't mean Saru. Like, I'm excluding Saru, I think, because Saru does this a lot. But
sure,
it's been the Book and Michael show for a long, long time. And there are interesting stories to tell with other characters, and I'd like to see more of that.
Me too. Do you want to get into the Priority One inbox, see if we got anything in there, my friend?
I'm already there.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Adam, our first Priority One message is from your brother, and it's to Jer Bear. It goes like this. I'm taking Adam up on his challenge for a Greatest Generation, Greatest Discovery crossover P1.
Hell yeah.
So I am once again walking up to Anybody Canyon and yelling, "Are you listening, Jer Bear Bear?" And now a Rolaren drop for old time's sake.
Wow. A little cross P1 action here.
Yeah, you rarely hear the Rolaren drop on Greatest Discovery, but it happens from time to time.
Yeah, the P1 makes it happen.
Yeah. Well, thank you, your brother, for that P1.
Hope you liked it, Jer Bear. Or I guess it could be Jerry Bear.
Oh, it could be Jerry Bear. Is there a pronunciation guide?
It could be Harry Bear if the J sounds like an H.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes it does.
It could be Harry Bear.
We'll never know. It could be Yaur Brother.
Ben, the next Priority One message is from Ding Man.
Ding Man. Mm.
And it is to Squirrel Patrol, a.k.a. Dan and Angie. Message goes like this. I want to thank the two of you for many wonderful things, not the least of which is getting me listening to the Uxbridge Shimoda brand of pod.
Hey.
After trying many Trek pods that were far too serious, Ben and Adam reignited my love for Trek in a new way. Thanks as well for being great friends in so many ways. Merry Xmas 2021.
Wow, a very belated Xmas P1. I like it.
I like that the note here from Ding Man says, whenever it's my turn is when you could play this one. Just keep the Xmas reference so we all remember when Drunk Ding Man bought this P1.
Drunk Ding Man happened.
So only a few short months ago.
Yeah.
Ding Man logged on and wrote this P1.
Indeed. If you're drunk right now and would like a P1, head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron and set one up. It helps us keep the lights on around here.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself an Edward Larkin?
Edward Larkin! It's really hard for me to throw that honor to anybody other than the person that did a Tribble-related thing in an episode. Mm. And the changeling in this episode turns into a Tribble.
That's a good call.
I was so curious about this changeling. I love the redesign of what the shape-shifting looks like. The kind of like particle effect look of that looked really great to me. And I want more changeling stuff. I'm so curious about what happened to the founders this far in the future of DS9. So it seems like this one really fell pretty far from grace if they're ripping off gamblers and Hazmazara's karma barge. But for turning into a Tribble, the changeling was my drunk Shimoda.
That was such an interesting moment to me because, like, much in the same way that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, mm-hmm. there was a time when founders were perceived as a type of magic, like a very special thing. And since making this jump into the far future, there's been a normalization of even the founder's style of magic. Like, they capture this founder, and I guess they're let go. There's not a big deal made out of their confinement or anything.
It would have been pretty funny to cut to the exterior of the karma barge and just see the founder get thrown out the front door into the ocean.
Right.
And then turn into like a whale and swim away.
It's so weird how founder technology or like the presence of a founder like doesn't even move the needle for anyone. Like, oh, another shapeshifter.
I have so many questions.
Yeah. My Edward Larkin is going to be Odo. Hey,
Mr. Bones. Odo? You got founders on the brain, my friend.
My Edward Larkin is Owo, obviously.
Oh, wow.
That's who I meant to say. Really, really trusting of Michael Burnham and her plan here for Owo's body and mm-hmm. how it's going to be used to earn money.
Unlicensed boxing.
I mean...
By the same token, Michael Burnham is very trusting of Owo's abilities of a fighter because... She gets in the ring with a guy that is fucking huge.
I expected that moment out of a Rocky film where Mickey turns to Rocky and is like, I got to stop the fight.
Yeah.
Or Rocky turns to Creed and is like, I got to stop the fight. Like, there's no moment where they realize she's outmatched. There's always confidence that she's going to hit him in the ding ding and is going to win all the money.
This episode needed that scene. It also needed the taping up the hand scene, like the mm-hmm. getting psyched up for the fight scene. I feel like it needed both.
Do you think the lack of that moment suggests that they always knew they were going to sandbag for the bigger odds and then buy in for the full amount at the very end to get the big payout? Is that what we're supposed to assume here?
I think it must be because especially in the context that they get accused of that exact thing by the fight promoter guy. But
I guess.
Yeah. I mean,
there's something a little clunky about that.
Yeah, that doesn't like peg the needle dramatic stakes wise.
If it's going to be a fight, give us all the conflicts inherent to that kind of situation.
Yeah. Well, good Larkin, my friend. We don't have any information about the next episode as of this recording. But if we get some before Wendy records the credits, she'll tell you all about it in these here credits. Take it away.
The Greatest Discovery is an Uxbridge Shimoda podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. Next week on the show, the guys will be reviewing episode 9 of season 4. It's called Rubicon. Captain Burnham and the USS Discovery race to stop Book and Tarka from launching a rogue plan that could inadvertently endanger the galaxy. The music that you hear on The Greatest Discovery is by Adam Ragusea. Make sure you're subscribed to his cooking channel over on YouTube. Bill Tilly runs all The Greatest Trek social media accounts. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter and use the hashtag Greatest Discovery to connect with us and other viewers online. If you want to support the show, you can do that in a number of different ways. You can recommend it to a friend or leave us a 5-star review online. You could get a P1 for an upcoming episode. Or become a member at MaximumFun.org/join. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with more of The Greatest Discovery.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.